Want to pull off the season's freshest trends? You just need the right shoes. That's where Designer Shoe Warehouse comes in. Loving wide-leg jeans? Pair them with sleek, low-profile sneakers. Obsessed with the sheer trend? Try it with mesh flats. Feeling boho? Comfy sandals nail the whole free-spirited thing. Find on-trend shoes from the brands you love, like Birkenstock, Nike, Adidas, and more at DSW.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I've been working with a nurse dietitian for the last 6 months, and it's been life-changing. I've lost weight, healed my relationship with food, and have way more energy. Working with a dietitian online to create a personalized nutrition plan was so easy thanks to Nourish. The best part? I pay $0 out of pocket because Nourish accepts hundreds of insurance plans. 94% of patients pay $0 out of pocket. Find your dietitian at usenourish.com. That's usenourish.com.
Thumbtack presents the ins and outs of caring for your home. Out. Indecision. Overthinking. Second-guessing every choice you make. In. Plans and guides that make it easy to get home projects done. Out. Beige on beige on beige. Ugh. In. Knowing what to do, when to do it, and who to hire. Start caring for your home with confidence. Download Thumbtack today.
Another beautiful spring day here in Louisiana and New Orleans. Highs of 70, well, 80 today, but first day of French Quarter Festival, perfect. Then a little bit cooler tomorrow, highs of 77, 73 on Saturday, 80 Sunday, nothing but sunshine. French Quarter Fest starts today, so get out and enjoy that. If you can, I would park outside of the quarter and make your way in because it's going to be a nightmare. 56 degrees right now. And we all know what happened. I think we all know what happened yesterday with the president and Trump, President Trump and tariffs and on, off, on, off, on, off. And one of the reasons behind it, he says, is to bring manufacturing back to the United States. Well, what would that look like and what would it take and what time frame are we talking about? Willie Shih joins us, our friend, professor of management practice at Harvard Business School. Good morning, professor. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. Well, I'm suffering a little from whiplash people ask me to talk about supply chain, and I have to change my talk every day depending on what's going on. You know, I tell a lot of people it's like, you know, business is conducted, it's like sports. It's conducted on a playing field, and you have these rules, right? So baseball season is coming up. It's like imagine you're coaching a team, and the rules change every 5 minutes. That's kind of what we're seeing right now, okay? But to your question, your question is like, well, the purpose of these tariffs is to bring manufacturing back to the U.S. It's like, yeah, I get it. Maybe that's, you know, when you looked at the initial rollout on Liberation Day, April 2nd, you know, it's like, okay, we're going to put a tariff on a lot of countries who export stuff that we never made. Okay, so that was kind of the crazy thing. You know, now the question is, what kinds of things can come back to the U.S.? Okay, and I would argue it's things where, you know, the amount of labor content in making that product is either relatively low or we're going to do something to juice up the productivity of our workers so that we can compete with a low-cost country. I mean, you know, we're paying, you know, anywhere from $15 to $50 an hour for manufacturing labor now, you know, and you're still competing with countries where they'll pay, you know, $2 to $8 an hour, right? So if there's a lot of labor in that product, then we got to do it differently. We're going to bring it back.
Let's talk about where we were before we talk about where we might go. And for people that don't know, weren't around, when did manufacturing in the U.S. really kind of start to shift offshore? And I'm thinking it was around the 70s. That was the end of the heyday of manufacturing in America or in production in America? Tell me, Professor.
No, it was really later than that. Okay, now in the 70s, that's when we, actually, the first big import wave, you know, was steel. It goes back to 1959 when United Steelworkers shut down American production for, I don't remember how long, it was probably, you know, it was a number of months. It was a pretty long shutdown. And that opened the door to imports from Germany and Japan primarily. Okay, so that was really, in some sense, offshoring some of that production back then.
So let me jump in real quick, Professor, if I can, because I get texts from people constantly that say it's the unions that cause jobs to go offshore. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I would say, you know, when we first started seeing like electronics manufacturing go offshore, you know, union or not, the cost difference was so high, right, that, like the really big move started in the late 90s and really early 2000s. Okay. And I'll tell you then when, you know, the minimum wage in the U.S. was around $7 an hour, but, you know, good manufacturing job might be $20 an hour. You could pay somebody 50 cents an hour in China. And so a lot of people said, I could hire 10 times as many people and I'll still be ahead of the game. And it was when China opened up, that's when we saw the really big waves. That's when we saw things like textile manufacturing really leave the U.S. That's when we saw, the rest of the electronics manufacturing that hadn't already moved. That's when we saw a lot of auto parts going. That's when we saw castings and forgings and stuff like that. So the really big jump was, you know, late 1990s, but really it really got going right around 9/11 in 2001. I remember that time very well because it's like we had a recession right after the attacks of the World Trade Center, you know, and everybody's saying, how am I going to make my numbers next year? And the way they were going to make their numbers is they're going to move production offshore. So we saw big waves of stuff. That's when like a lot of pharmaceutical manufacturing moved offshore, a lot of the stuff. A lot of that was also because we had more efficient container ships. We had more efficient air cargo, right? So while we had a lot of, you know, some of that offshoring, you know, especially like for assembling TV sets and stuff like that and radios and stuff like that in the 60s and 70s, it really got going in the late 90s and early 2000s.
So when you talk about we can get this, we're worried about, I forgot exactly how you said it just now, but after 9/11 with the recession, how can we cut our costs? Yeah. I think sometimes people think of it as the Chinese invading or Vietnam invading and taking jobs, but actually it was American companies that decided to move offshore. So if you're looking for somebody to blame the executives of the companies and the shareholders, activist shareholders, et cetera, they're concerned about profits and the price of the stock. Is that accurate?
Well, that's part of the picture. Okay, I was at one of those companies, and I remember calling on a large retailer headquartered in Bentonville. Mm-hmm. Okay, and they told me at the time, if you don't manufacture in China, you're not going to sell in this store. Mm. Okay, and, you know, by the way, we had a boom of low-cost products, you know, and it kept inflation in check, you know, for better part of a decade and a half.
But wait, right? And so, let me jump in, Professor. In that case, it was an American retailer that forced the company to go offshore. Accurate or not?
Well, let me go a little farther downstream. Okay. So you're in Home Depot, right? I mean, let's talk about who are the five largest importers in the U.S., right? Walmart, Target, Home Depot, Lowe's, and Ashley Furniture, right? So let's say you're in Home
Walmart,
Depot.
Target.
Home Depot, Lowe's, and Ashley Furniture. Those are those are typically the largest importers, you know. And so, like you're in one of these stores, okay? And you see something made in China, and it costs half as much. What are you going to buy right now? It's like I'm very grateful that I'm in a position that I can buy American, okay? But a lot of people can't, okay? A lot of my neighbors where I live can't, right? And so, I don't want to judge that, right? Because they're living paycheck to paycheck, mm-hmm. right? And I get that, right? And so if I can get something cheaper. So it's a whole system problem, if you will. It's, you know, everybody contributes to it, but it's, you know, we get a lot of stuff that is a lot cheaper that comes from China. When you think about construction, like I was talking to a company that makes the roofing nails. Okay. Or, well, they make the gun that shoots the roofing nails, and the roofing nails all come from China. Right. And so that means your housing is cheaper because you got cheaper nails. Right. So it's a big, complicated problem.
Let me take a break. You hesitate to what, Professor? And we got to take a break.
Yeah, I just said I hesitate to blame any one party, but it's like this is how we got to where we got to.
All right, let me take a break. We come back. You talk about whiplash. How does the uncertainty with the tariffs, the on-off, how does that affect companies' decisions about manufacturing, and what's a time frame? What would it look like for manufacturing to come back to the United States? Because the president says you got to have some pain if you're going to have some gain. And I just wonder, how long do you have pain before the medicine kicks in and you got the gain? 622 traffic now, WWL.
From the Acadian Windows and Hurricane Shutters WWL Traffic Center, I'm Joe Cardos. The I-55 is all clear as you head in from Ponchatoula, and 310 is still looking good as you move in from Destrehan as well. The Bonnie Carey Spillway is moving at speed after some initial congestion as you head in from Laplace. I-10 has no major delays between Kenner and Metairie, and the causeway is still flowing freely this morning to and from the North Shore. Smooth sailing across the Twin Spans as you head in from Slidell, and no delays through the Morrison Curve. Slowing a bit as you approach the high rise as you head in from the east, but moving better after that. Headed toward downtown from the east on I-10, you're looking good all the way till the Claiborne flyover, which is seeing a bit of congestion. The Pontchartrain Expressway is all clear as you head to the CBD. Moving in from the West Bank, you are on the brakes across the Crescent City connection right now. No delays across the Huey P in either direction. This morning's traffic is brought to you by the 4Kids Foundation.
All right, 6:27, 3 minutes left with Professor Willie Shih, Professor of Management Practice at Harvard Business School, talking about manufacturing returning to the U.S. Walmart, Target, Home Depot, Lowe's, Ashley Furniture, five largest importers. So, Professor, my questions to you are, first of all, where does tariff uncertainty play into this when it comes to the uncertainty with tariffs and capital investment? What's the timeline on your manufacturing returning to the U.S.? Where do robotics fit into this? And inevitably, does that mean prices are going to go up if manufacturing returns to the U.S.? The floor is yours, sir.
Well, okay. It's going to depend on the sector, right? Some areas will see a very short-term effect. I tell people, for example, in agricultural products, fresh produce and stuff, you know, what will happen is people will decide, am I going to keep exporting to the U.S. because I can't afford to pay a tariff and so on. Okay, so like right now, everything's suspended for 90 days, but, you know, that's a relatively short cycle. If you're talking about moving auto parts manufacturing, right, it depends, do I have factory capacity, do I have to build a factory and so on. So depending on the sector, you know, the president has been targeting semiconductors. He said, you know, to the Taiwanese, it's like, move your factory over here. To get enough capacity to meet American demand for semiconductors, my view, that would probably take 10 years and, you know, $500 billion. Mm. A lot of money, a lot of time, right? So depending on what sector you're in, it's going to take a different amount of time. When we have this level of uncertainty, nobody's going to make any decisions. Okay, everybody's going to wait until the dust settles because, you know, let's say I put a factory down in the U.S. and all of a sudden the tariff goes away, you know, then I have a higher cost operation, right? So until we get the dust settled and people have a view that long term is, you know, outside my investment horizon, this thing is going to stick, then I can justify it. Until then, you know, with high uncertainty, all we're going to do is stifle investment.
So if manufacturing does return, do prices automatically go up? And can people right now, if they want to buy American, choose to stop shopping at Walmart, Target, Home Depot, Lowe's, and Ashley Furniture?
Well, you know, and Walmart and all these firms are trying to diversify their sourcing as well. You know, Walmart has a big Buy American program. You know, mostly where that helps them is in things like grocery and stuff like that. But you know, if it comes back to the U.S., unless we do some nifty things with automation and stuff to get our labor productivity up, it's probably going to cost more. All right. And one of the reasons we've had low inflation over the last, until recently, you know, from 2000 until recently, we've had low inflation is because we had cheap imports. Okay. So we cut off the cheap imports and, you know, have more expensive manufacturing in the U.S. Stuff's going to cost more, right? So you can't have it both ways.
Thank you, Professor. Appreciate your time as always. We'll talk to you again soon, I'm sure. We'll take a break and back talk to Louisiana Agricultural Commissioner Mike Strain. Right now, time for WWL First News. 6:45, 6:46, call it 14 till 7. Mike Strain joins us now, as he does every Thursday morning. Commissioner, Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry. How you doing, Mike Strain?
Man, I'm great. It's strawberry time.
Yeah, you're right.
For the Strawberry Festival starts tomorrow at noon till 10 p.m. Then Saturday, I'll be there Saturday. That's the big day from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. We'll have the parade. It'll roll out around 9:15. We expect over 100,000 people or more on the route. And then Sunday from 10 to 7. It's a whole lot of fun. You know, if you want all things strawberries, you've got to be in Ponchatoula. It's really... You know, it's a local festival. It's a family festival. The strawberry farmers are selling their products. It's just absolutely a delicious, good time. We'll have Jazzy out there, the official strawberry mascot, and just having a whole lot of fun. And, of course, it goes on for 3 days. There's music. There's all sorts of food. It's going to be a beautiful weekend. I just can't wait. It is time to have some fun.
We spoke to the Strawberry Queen the other day. She's a very impressive young lady. I don't mind telling you that.
Yes,
Alexis Lee.
Yes, she is. You know, these queens, they are incredible, and they represent their area and their crops very, very well. And the queens, they all go to Washington Mardi Gras. That's a big part of Washington Mardi Gras, where all the festival queens, all the commodity queens are there, and they're presented as a formal court. They're there as ambassadors to the state. And so being a queen is a lot of work. You have to go to a lot of functions. And you got to be up on your toes. They're well spoken.
Yes, they are. And she looked. She knew the strawberry. She knew the strawberry business. And they asked her about challenges facing strawberry farmers during the competition. She had a great answer for that. So she knows her stuff, man.
Yes, and I think she's a third or fourth generation strawberry family. There, I think she's related to the Liuzas. And of course, yes, it's really good. And I will actually see the strawberry royalty later today here in Baton Rouge. So we'll be, again, talking all things strawberries, the finest, the greatest, and the sweetest. So it's going to be a lot of fun.
Mike, let me ask it this way real quick. For somebody that is contemplating going, either from the south, the north, east, west, whatever, tell them how to get there and where to park and all that stuff. Because sometimes people want to go, but they can be a little bit overwhelmed by it all.
Yes, yes. And so I would get there. If you're going to go for the parade, say, on Saturday, you need to try to arrive about 8 a.m. There's parking all around the Main Street. It's on Main Street in Ponchatoula. And so you can park all the way around there. And so that's the kind of way it works. So there'll be plenty of parking, and you kind of walk towards the festival. The festival takes over, you know, all of downtown Ponchatoula. So, you know, you just take the interstate and get off at the Ponchatoula exit there from the interstate, and you would head directly east, and it'll bring you into the center town. And then, you know, just start, you take one of the side roads and start looking for a place to park.
And I'm guessing there's going to be a lot of signs directing people where to go, what to do, et cetera.
Everything, yes. They're very good about that. You could actually go down to, you know, they have several parks. You know, you can go down to the Kiwanis Park or the Rotary Park. But it's a little ways, but you can park fairly close. Actually, a lot of people park right along the railroad track. You go down the Main Street, you see the railroad track, generally take a right and go down just a little bit and find a place to park. But get there a little early. If you get there at 8 a.m. on Saturday, you'll be fine. You'll be able to find a place to park. Or if you want to go Friday, I'd get there about 11 a.m. It starts at noon, and Sunday about 9 a.m., and you'll find a place to park.
So this week, Passion Sunday, whatever they call it, Palm Sunday, and then we got
Palm Sunday.
Palm Sunday.
And
then we got Easter Sunday the following week, Lent's line winding down. So let's talk seafood. Let's talk about some stuff for Easter that people can prepare on their table from Louisiana. And don't forget that Easter basket.
So yesterday I was at Jay Bernard's Seafood there and his wife Georgia in Cottonport. And they boil about 7,000 pounds of crawfish an hour. You got that?
Wow.
An hour. It's a huge operation. They buy the local crawfish, and you know, and it goes both peeled. It goes so you can make your etouffee. They also sell live crawfish as well, and then they have a flash frozen 3-pound bags of crawfish that you simply put the whole bag in boiling water. And so the seafood.
Wait, already peeled and everything?
No, they're still not peeled. They're whole. They're shelled.
But
you put this bag in water for 10 minutes and it's ready to go.
Wow.
Yes.
How many come in a bag? What kind of pound did you talk about?
3 pounds. 3 pounds. They
That's
used to
cool.
do 3 and 5. 3 pounds of crawfish. You can find it at Rouse's, and most of this actually goes into the Midwest. They go out there, and I guess when they cook those big Midwestern steaks, they have that crawfish as well.
So it's already seasoned and in a bag. And seasoned and in a bag, so you throw the vacuum bag in the boiling water, and it comes out like it's coming out of a boil.
That's right,
okay.
And it tastes just as good. It's incredible, and you know, and they've got it. They have got this down pat how to do it.
Let's talk about some chocolate.
Oh my goodness, Elmer's, right? It's got to be Elmer's, Heavenly Hash, right? You know, and Elmer's is right there in Ponchatoula, you know, and so that's a company that's been around for well over 100 years. And Elmer's, you got to think about Heavenly Hash, you know, their pecan eggs.
Gold brick.
Oh, my. Gold bricks. Mm. Oh, my goodness. Now, you take the gold brick egg and you put that on top of some Bluebell ice cream. You kind of chop it up or melt it up and put that on top of Bluebell ice cream. Yes. That is the definition of something that is just absolutely delicious.
And
since
we're talking about strawberries, I should also say that there's
strawberry
absolutely. Heavenly Hash egg now that you could try that I'm a big fan of.
Yeah, and I take strawberries and I just freeze them just raw, and I pull them out of the freezer and let them thaw maybe a minute and eat them frozen like that.
Yeah,
you know, when you eat that, when you have that strawberry in that ice cream, you know how delicious that strawberry is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can do that by just eating them right out of the freezer.
There's one of my favorite things to get at Middendorf is that strawberry ice cream, Mike.
Oh yes, yes. Well, at Middendorf, you know, you cannot go wrong. Right, with that thin fried catfish.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, last time I was at Middendorf's, I was there with Steve Scalise, and I think we tried to see if we could eat all the catfish they had. We didn't, but it was a really good time. And you've got a seafood festival coming up there in Belchase, and that is going to be on April 25th, 27th. And that is there at Belchase at off Edward Hebert Road. And so a lot of festivals going on.
Mike, real quick, let's talk about tariffs. I want to get into tariffs and timber and all of that stuff. What will help, what will hurt?
So if you look at the tariffs, one of the things is that we've been getting dumping of timber in the United States from Canada and from China. And the tariffs will definitely help that. You know, as we've been fighting with Canada for dumping their softwoods into our markets. Because in Canada, they cut the timber and they pay little to no stumpage fee. Here, you know, when we cut timber, you got to pay the owner of the timber, you know, for the timber. And so they would bring it here cheaper than we could cut it right here. And so that is going to help that. And then with China dumping plywood on our markets, we've lost a lot of our manufacturing, our plywood mills. This will help level that playing field. For seafood, also, there's going to be tariffs on imported seafood. And that will help our local seafood producers, especially when you start looking at shrimp and crawfish are really in that order. And we're talking about all this crawfish, we need to talk about shrimp too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we need to rebuild our local shrimp economy. You know, people, you know, you're not going to go and buy imported crawfish to boil. You're just simply not going to do it. But people will buy imported shrimp. And so we've got to really start, you know, the ask before you eat, where does the seafood come from? And really try to rebuild and reestablish our shrimp market. And these festivals are a big part, but also that where we start, eating more shrimp and more crawfish. And when's the last time you had a hamper of crabs? And they are really good, you know. So, and you can get those crabs. So we need to really work on our seafood industry and consume all of our products locally.
Mike, a pleasure as always. Have a great time at the Strawberry Fest.
Yes, and hopefully Teddy's doing well, right?
Teddy, well, yeah, I don't know. He was out there in the poor thunderstorm digging a hole on Sunday. I don't know what's going through his head. Thank you, Mike.
Well, you know, take care. Bye.
You too. Bye. All right, Mike Strain, 655, 5 till 7, traffic now, WWL.
From the Acadian Windows and Hurricane Shutters WWL Traffic Center, I'm Joe.
We're talking about the Masters. That's a rite of spring. Unfortunately, also another rite of spring is river levels, and that's the harbinger to hurricane season. Beautiful weekend. Great weekend to head out to the Ponchatoula Strawberry Fest or the French Quarter Fest. But what's going to happen weeks down the line? Clint Wilson joins us now, Dean of the College of the Coast and Environment at LSU, to talk about it. How you doing, Professor?
Hey, good morning, Tommy. Nice to talk to you.
Is it Dr. Wilson?
Yes, it is.
All right, Dr. Wilson.
Clint is fine.
All right, Clint. Let's talk. The last time I was at the river in Belchase, it's a dumb thing, but it was a couple of weeks ago, and I got a 5-gallon bucket full of old golf balls. So when I get bored, I'll go out to the levee and drive some into the river. And the water was pretty meek at that point. They had a lot of batchered before you even got to the water. So what's the deal now, and what do we have to watch or look forward to or worry about as it relates to the Mississippi River spillway, et cetera? I guess it all goes back to what happens way up north, right?
That's correct. You're 100% right there, Tommy. You know, what was probably early April, right? There was a bunch of rain in the kind of Midwest, Southeast. You know, you look in the, you know, you realize the Mississippi River, you know, drains, what, 42% of the continental United States. So that includes a lot of the Midwest, some of the Northeast, et cetera, in the north part of the United States. So what happens up there, you know, eventually impacts us here in Louisiana and the Mississippi River in Louisiana. So, you know, they got a significant amount of rain. I'm not sure if you've seen, you know, some of the reports in Kentucky, Illinois, Indiana, you know, where they got up to 10 to 15 inches of rain in a day or 2 days. And, you know, that water's got to go somewhere. So it eventually ends up in the Ohio River and the Mississippi River, even Arkansas River, Black and White Rivers, I believe, both also received that, those watersheds received a lot of rain. So that all that water eventually makes its way into the main stem of the Mississippi River, right? So, you know, thanks to the good work by people at the, you know, United States Geological Survey, the National Weather Service, Corps of Engineers, you know, we know kind of what's happening up there, and we know, and we have a really good idea what's how fast that water is going to move down river. And it takes a while, right? You know, you're starting to see places like Memphis and Vicksburg, you know, Cairo, well, start north, Cairo, Illinois, and then down towards, you know, Memphis and Vicksburg, et cetera. You're starting to see the water levels in the Mississippi River rise to flood stage in those areas. Now, flood stage doesn't mean, right, and I think a lot of us know that now, but it's always good to remind people, when we say flood stage, we don't mean the Mississippi River is going to flood over the levees, right? We just mean it's going to get out of its natural bank. So exactly like you were talking about hitting golf balls, right? The water was down in the main channel. The batcher was dry or relatively dry. And so basically, yeah, what's happening is, you know, probably a month ago, maybe the river was up a little bit. It started to come down because there wasn't a lot of rain or snow melt yet. But those rains I talked about in early April, they're now coming down, right? So, you know, what we're looking at is, you know, Carol, you know, the Corps of Engineers does a great job of, I think, of warning the public, keeping people updated on what's happening. And so, you know, they typically will use the Carrollton Gauge there in New Orleans, right by the New Orleans District Corps of Engineers office, to help people understand kind of where they are, right, where they are in terms of their flood fight preparations and inspections, et cetera. So really what we're doing is we're watching for when that flood wave is going to come down and start impacting the core and you know, what we need to be looking for. I hope that answers your question, Tommy.
It does.
Towards what you want.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. And if y'all have any questions, let me open it to the Oakland Art Jeweler talk and text line, 504-260-1870. Please do not text and drive. And text and data rates may apply. I think I'm supposed to tell you that. 720 now, traffic, WWL. 725, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking with Dr. Clint Wilson, although he'd prefer we call him Clint, Dean of the College of the Coast and Environment at LSU. So when will we know, Clint, how hard is it to predict rainfall that has already happened, what's going to occur?
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof like Aloe, Allbirds, or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling and for shoppers buying simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet and the not so secret secret with Shop Pay that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whenever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout experience as business powerhouses like Aloe, Allbirds, and Skims. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
Hey, I'm Andy. If you don't know me, it's probably because I'm not famous. But I did start a men's grooming company called Harry's. The idea for Harry's came out of a frustrating experience I had buying razor blades. Most brands were overpriced, overdesigned, and out of touch. At Harry's, our approach is simple. Here's our secret. We make sharp, durable blades and sell them at honest prices for as low as $2 each. We care about quality so much that we do some crazy things, like buy a world-class German blade factory. Obsessing over every detail means we're confident in offering a 100% quality guarantee. Millions of guys have already made the switch to Harry's, so thank you if you're one of them. And if you're not, we hope you give us a try with this special offer. Get a Harry starter set with a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, shave gel, and a travel cover. All for just $3 plus free shipping. Just go to harrys.com and enter code MAN at checkout. That's harrys.com, code MAN. Enjoy!
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Hi, this is Debbie, your Blinds.com design consultant.
Oh, wow, a real person.
Yep, I'm here to help you with everything from selecting the perfect window treatments to...
I've got a complicated project.
No problem. We make the complex simple. And I can even help schedule a professional measure and install.
I didn't realize you did that.
Yeah, we can also send you samples, fast and free.
Wow, I mean, I always thought I needed a designer to come to my home, but scheduling's always a nightmare.
Not with Blinds.com. We're on your schedule, and there's no haggling, no pressure, no hidden fees either.
I just might have to do more.
Oh, okay, whatever you need. How about you tell me what you had in mind?
Okay, then. So the first room we're looking at is for guests coming over.
Blinds.com has covered over 25 million windows, all backed by a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 40% site-wide. Rules and restrictions may apply.
And can you accurately predict whether or not the spillway is going to be needs to be open or not, or do you just have to wait and see?
No, that's a great question. I think that, you know, the tools that the National Weather Service, the Corps of Engineers, United States Geological Survey have are excellent. So, you know, we have a good idea of, you know, when the rising waters, how fast the water will rise in places like Baton Rouge and New Orleans. Of course, that's based on the rainfall that fell up in the Midwest and kind of parts of the Northeast, you know, a week or two ago. So, you know, the projections we're looking at now, you know, show that the river in New Orleans will crest probably around April 26th or 27th, below the levels that require the Bonnecary spillway to open. You know, so right now the projection, the forecast is, you know, the Bonnecary wouldn't have to be open. However, you know, the Corps of Engineers will have to go into what they call their phase one and phase two kind of actions. And that involves, you know, anyone wanting to do construction or earthwork within 1,500 feet of the levee have to get permits or have to get approval from the Corps of Engineers, because you don't want to weaken the levee or, you know, provide any ways for, you know, seepage to have an impact on the levees or the surrounding area. So, you know, that's going to come up here in the next probably week or so as far as the phase one, if not before that. Phase two just means everything's got to stop construction-wise in terms of, you know, 1,500 feet, 2,000 feet away from the levee. So the projection, I think the forecast is good. What I may want to add before, you know, we take some questions if you've got them, is that, you know, that's based on the fact that, you know, it rained early in April right up in those areas. So we have a really good idea how long it's going to take that water to come down. You know, what we're looking at now is what are the projections, what are the forecasts for rainfall in the next week or two? And, you know, right now they look pretty good. Doesn't look like we're going to get much rain.
Somebody texted in, first of all, and is a minor thing about me driving golf balls into the water that I shouldn't, that I shouldn't do that. Am I hurting anything by doing that, Professor?
Well, I was going to say that's probably not a good idea, Tommy.
Tell me why. No, I'm not arguing. I just want to know why.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think there's enough debris and plastics and other material in the river, right? So I would think we'd want to, you know, do our best to keep foreign objects out of the river.
I guess I'll go back to driving them from my backyard into my neighbors' houses. But you're the one that told me to do it, Clint. No, seriously.
Exactly.
Somebody wanted to know about the size of the Mississippi River Basin and how hard it is to calculate all of that and put all of that together and figure out what's going to happen down here.
That's a great question. I think, you know, over the, you know, last couple decades, and particularly the last couple years, you know, with the, you know, the federal government's support of, you know, rainfall forecasting and the gauges and the observation stations that are out in the basin, you know, I think we've gotten a lot better at forecasting what's happened, you know, whether that's, you know, snow melt in Minnesota, or whether that's rainfall in, you know, Montana or Missouri or, you know, Western Pennsylvania. So, you know, we've gotten a lot better at that. And you know, that's thanks to, you know, the observation, you know, the stations that are out there measuring rainfall and measuring water levels and measuring flow rates and, you know, numerical modeling of the river and how long it takes that water to get down. So, you know, we're doing a lot better, but, you know, again, that's, you know, thanks to a lot of efforts, you know, by National Weather Service, USGS, Corps, et cetera.
Are you worried about any kind of cuts to any of those agencies?
Well, that's okay. That's probably where we were headed, right? Yeah. When I was talking about that. And I think that is something I think the public needs to be very aware of, is that, you know, those observations, the experts, it's, you know, from the technicians to the scientists to the engineers that work in those different air parts of the Mississippi River watershed, you know, they're the experts in their local area, and they're the ones who maintain the equipment. They're the ones who understand the way the water flows and moves down their parts of the river. And then from a bigger picture, you've got scientists and engineers who then take that, you know, take the modeling, understand the physics, take the data, and they're able to then kind of make this comprehensive forecast of what's happening and then provide us with the ability to say, you know, shoot, the way it looks is, you know, the Mississippi River in New Orleans isn't going to crest until, you know, April 26th or 27th. Well, you know, we didn't really know how to do that a couple of decades ago, and now we can do that. And so I think we need to be very aware of that and keep that in the public's mind as we think about cuts and you know, staffing reductions.
Professor Dr. Clint Wilson, Dean of the College of the Coast and Environment at LSU, I appreciate you and the work you do. We should mention that as well, sir, and thank you for your time today. And I'll stop driving I'll stop driving balls into the Mississippi.
Please do that. All right, have a good day.
Thank you, sir. All right. Another thing taken away from Tommy. 7:30, we'll take a break, come back. Right now, time for WWL First News. 7:46, 14 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Daniel Erspammer, welcoming him in, CEO of the Pelican Institute, talk about a poll that they conducted to see what Louisianians voters were concerned about with this session. How you doing, Daniel?
Hey, good morning. Doing all right. Good to be with you.
Tell me about what made you do the poll, and what did you ask, and what did you find?
Yeah, you know, one of the things we try to do regularly is get a pulse for where voters are, what their interests are, where their priorities are. And we thought, particularly given the legislative session that is going to kick off on Monday, it would be a good time to sort of figure out where they are on key issues. And, you know, the headline, I think, is by and large, voters are pleased with the policy progress that the legislature and the governor have made over the last year and are eager to see additional changes come.
I would have to believe that insurance would be at the top of the list, huh?
It is. You know, couple of things we see from the poll on this. One is 74% of respondents said that their insurance premiums increased over the last year. No surprise there. In fact, maybe a little surprise. It's not even higher. And then we wanted to understand, you know, to what extent did voters believe that lawsuit abuse was a major driver of those premium increases. And overall, nearly 60% of people said that they agreed, or they strongly agreed with that. And if you look at the people who either strongly or somewhat agree, 61% of Democrats, 81% of independents, and 84% of Republicans all said lawsuit abuse is the major driver of insurance premium increases.
So with that being said, the governor had his news conference yesterday. I don't know if you want to venture into these waters or not, but he called out one trial attorney. He went hunting with another one last week. How confident are you, or how hopeful are you that something's going to actually be done? Because I got to tell you, Daniel, I first of all, let me take a step back. If you look at the tail of the tape, if you will, if you compare auto insurance rates with here and Texas, here and Mississippi, as I hear so many times from so many people, what's the difference? Why is it so much higher here? Because you would think basically everything's equal other than, and the answer would be what?
That's right. Other than a significantly higher level of litigation related to particularly related to auto issues here in Louisiana.
Say that again, sir.
So the big thing that's different is the level of litigation, the amount of litigation that happens in Louisiana relative to those other states, particularly around auto issues.
So how do you go about parsing that? Because the attorneys wouldn't do it if there was no cheese at the end of the tunnel, right? So how is it, the judicial system, the state law? Where does the cheese present itself?
Yeah, and look, you know, let me be clear. I mean, I don't blame the attorneys all that much. They're taking advantage of a system that exists.
Right? This is America. So you play just like golf, Daniel. You play by the rules. Sometimes it takes the tree out of play. Sometimes not. You play by the rules.
Right.
Go ahead.
Exactly right. So, you know, you look at the system and what we have is a situation where you've got aggressive attorneys who are, again, playing by the rules that have for years, you couldn't even take something to a jury unless it was $50,000 or more. So what you saw were settlements, lots of them, at $49,999. Mm-hmm. You know, and that threshold has been lower, but we're still seeing a lot of settlements at that range. And, you know, a lot of states don't even have a jury trial threshold to begin with. Another issue we have in Louisiana that's not true everywhere is we call it a collateral source rule. So let's say you're in an auto accident. You have some medical costs. The defendant is found liable for the injuries. Well, what the jury sees is what I call the rack rate, the sort of list price for the hospital, the doctor, you know, all those things. Well, nobody actually pays that amount. By the time insurance companies or if you're a cash payer, your cash payment is negotiated, those costs are a lot lower. But juries in Louisiana can only see that high-level rate that is sort of the list price for these services. So they're seeing vastly exaggerated costs and awarding damages or awards based on those numbers.
Do you think it, well, let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. 751, 9 till 8. Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Daniel Erspammer, CEO of the Pelican Institute. When we come back, we'll talk about the likelihood of anything actually being done to change insurance rates. I think it's highly unlikely, but we'll see. I also want to talk about education and Gator and funding Gator. We're going to talk to Kirk Talbot in a little bit about some of his bills, recent discussions with the governor about the insurance crisis. And also, Cameron Henry's pushing back on the Gator scholarship program. Some people think that it's just subsidizing people that are already sending their kids to private school. We'll talk about that and more when we return. 752, 8 till 8, Traffic Now, WWL. 7:58, Tommy Tucker, WWL, a couple of minutes left with Daniel Erspammer, CEO of the Pelican Institute. Somebody said, don't blame the trial lawyers, they're taking advantage. Nah, I got to agree with Daniel on this one. They're just playing by the rules. You want to blame somebody, blame the legislature and the laws that exist. They're the ones that need to change it. Let's get to the Gator program. What do people say about that, Daniel?
Yeah, a very favorable opinion. We had almost 60% of voters across the state say that they were they had a very favorable or somewhat favorable opinion of the new Gator program. And importantly, 63% of voters said they believe that it should be fully funded, that every child who applies, we're now up to over 32,000 students who have qualified for the program, have signed up with a week left yet to register. 63% say we ought to fully fund it.
So for people that say, Daniel, it's nothing but a subsidy for people already sending their kids to private schools, that it's going to eventually morph into that, you would say what?
I said this is about a new way to deliver education. The dollars of the state follow the child to the school that fits them best. And what we'll see is a number of these children are already in, some of them will already be in private school, and low-income families are scraping together every penny they can to make that happen. But we'll see this as eventually universal. It applies equally to every kid in the state.
So eventually people that are not struggling financially will get money from the Gator Scholarship Program to send that are already sending their kids to private schools. They'll just basically get help paying the tuition. Accurate?
That is accurate. It's a lower amount, award amount for families that are above 250% of poverty. But eventually this...
MLB.TV is home to baseball's biggest stars. Watch every out-of-market game, live or on demand.
He got it! Woo! This is unbelievable!
Plus, you'll get 24/7 access to MLB Network. Stream every big pitch.
He struck him out!
Every home run.
Gone!
Everything baseball. All season long on MLB.TV. Start a free trial today. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
Street Easy asked former New Yorkers if there's anything they miss about life in New York City.
Let me put it this way. House with a home theater sounds appealing. But that's until you realize you no longer have a theater district.
Whether you're looking to rent or it's time to buy, Street Easy has the local expertise you need to never leave NYC. Go to StreetEasy.com to learn more. Street Easy is an assumed name of Zillow Inc., which has licenses in all 50 states.
Hey, I'm Josh Fink, owner of Nick's Menswear. Getting married? Don't rent some random suit. At Nick's, we help you own the look for about the same price as a rental. You're marrying the love of your life. Don't you deserve a suit that's yours forever? Nick's Menswear, your friend in style.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Greene from the Commercial Break Podcast. It's likely you've heard of the show if you're directly related to me or you follow our MySpace page. But I'm not here to talk to those three listeners. I'm here to appeal to people who haven't heard the show. Along with my co-host, Kristen Joy Hoadley, we're taking a deeper look at the topics that are affecting our youth today. Like, who are the people who are dating ghosts? Where did all these pickup artists come from? And why doesn't my preacher have a nicer private jet? We understand that these are the issues you really want to get to the bottom of. The Commercial Break is now available on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts.
Will be available to all families in Louisiana.
Thank you, Daniel. Appreciate your time, CEO of the Pelican Institute. We come back, we'll talk to Dr. Brent Wallace, Chief Medical Officer of People's Health, Dr. B, about getting enough sleep. 8:16. Now, I remember years ago I learned an expression I'd never heard before. I slept hard last night. And it's like, what does that mean? Slept hard. It means they slept well. Well, more than one in three American adults do not sleep hard or well. They don't get enough sleep. Dr. B, Dr. Brent Wallace, our friend, Chief Medical Officer of People's Health, joins us to Talk about why that's a problem. Plus, he has some tips for us for a better night's rest. How'd you sleep last night, Dr. B?
Hey, Tommy. I actually did pretty good last night.
Had you heard the expression, I slept hard before, or not?
I have. Yeah, definitely. I hear it all the time.
Really? Okay, so how much sleep do we need?
Yeah, you need a lot more than most people are getting, actually. The CDC actually recommends that adults are supposed to get between about 7 and 9 hours of sleep per night. Mm. And it's that range because sleep needs they're going to vary person to person, you know, depending on who you are. Some people may need a little bit more. Some people may be a little bit less to wake up and really feel refreshed. And then keep in mind that as you age, your sleep needs may change a little bit as well.
How do we know if we're getting enough sleep?
Yeah, really that high quality or hard sleep, like you were saying, should give you the full benefits of that 7 to 9 hours. If you're sleeping really well and for long enough, you should wake up in the morning and feel really rested and restored and actually a little bit energized. And, you know, the contrary would be if you wake up feeling really tired or foggy, even if you think you got a full night's rest, you might not be getting really good quality sleep. It may be lower quality sleep. And some things to watch for, you know, if you have difficulty staying awake during the day, that's something to be really concerned about. A lot of people may have problems concentrating or remembering things or even having conversations first thing in the morning. And then some people actually may have trouble controlling their emotions, you know, kind of like a toddler when they get too tired.
What causes poor sleep, doctor?
Yeah, I mean, it can be related to a lot of things, but sleep habits are really, really critical. You know, some of the things we do actually cause poor sleep. So if you're drinking a lot of caffeine right before bed, obviously that's going to not set you up for a really good night's sleep. It's going to keep you awake. And then some people, it may be related to things like stress and anxiety. So you're trying to go to sleep, but your mind is really active and thinking about all those things you're stressed out about. We call that rumination. There are some health conditions and additional, you know, things like breathing problems or in particular chronic pain can cause problems with sleep. And then you could have what we call an actual sleep disorder. And that's a medical condition that needs to be diagnosed and treated. And often they're not treated for certain patients.
What is a sleep disorder?
So really a sleep disorder is any condition that keeps you from getting restful sleep. And there are a lot of them. You know, it's very normal for people to have trouble sleeping from time to time. But if it becomes a really consistent problem where night after night you're having difficulty either falling asleep or staying asleep, that may be a sleep disorder. And so the most common one that we see is called insomnia. And a lot of people know what insomnia is. They may not realize, though, insomnia could be that difficulty falling asleep. It may also be where you wake up in the middle of the night or maybe too early in the morning. That can also be insomnia. And then one of the other ones we see really frequently is something called sleep apnea. And sleep apnea is a medical condition that actually causes you to stop breathing while you're sleeping. And it could be a physical thing, like an obstruction or a blockage in your airway. Often it's either large tonsils or maybe a really large tongue that kind of stops you from getting air in. Or it could be more central, where your brain is not controlling your breathing correctly. And that lack of oxygen that occurs will trigger sort of your survival instinct, and it'll wake you up from sleep very abruptly.
Is that something you should talk to your doctor about, sleep problems?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is something when you come in for your PCP visit, you want to definitely bring this up with your doctor. Your doctor may check to see if those are related to a health condition you have, or, you know, they could even be a side effect of a certain medication you're taking for a different medical condition. And if we think you might have an actual sleep disorder, often we will refer you to get something called a sleep study. And what a sleep study is it's a test that we do overnight. it actually can be done in your home or it can be in a sleep center. And what it does is it monitors your brain activity, your oxygenation, your blood pressure, all those bodily functions while you're sleeping so that we can try to make a diagnosis.
Now let's take a break. More with Dr. B from People's Health when we come back about getting enough sleep. More than 1 in 3 Americans don't get enough sleep. There's a millennial that works for our company here in this building that started doing a morning show a couple of years ago. And they asked me, what's the trick to getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning? And I said, there is no trick. You're going to be tired for the rest of your life. 821 traffic now, WWL. 826, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Dr. B, our friend Dr. Brent Wallace from People's Health, Chief Medical Officer at People's Health. We're talking about sleep, how important it is to get enough sleep. 1 in 3 Americans do not get enough. So, Doc, what happens if you don't get enough sleep?
Yeah, I mean, in the short term, it's going to make you feel tired. It may worsen your mood. You might even have trouble making certain decisions. But long term, it can cause a lot more complications, things like, you know, weakening your immune system and making you more susceptible to infection. It can increase your risk for depression and anxiety, and it can actually cause certain health conditions like high blood pressure.
Is it possible to change the way you sleep or improve it, or are you like you are?
No. You absolutely can make changes. The healthy steps won't actually fix sleep disorders. Those generally require medical treatment, but there are a lot of things you can do.
Well, what are some tips for better sleep?
The biggest thing is really consistency. So you want to try to go to sleep and wake up at the same time every day. And really that includes weekends as well, because that consistency will kind of train your body and your brain to feel tired when you need to feel tired and then ready to go in the morning. And then, like I mentioned before, don't set yourself up for failure. Don't drink caffeine or alcohol really late in the day, because that's going to cause problems. And a lot of people don't realize alcohol, even though it is a sedative, can actually cause you to wake up in the middle of the night and then have trouble falling back asleep.
So if you wake up, you should have another drink. I'm just kidding. What else can we do?
Yeah, I mean, really critical is having a good sleep environment, and a lot of people don't do this. You know, you want to make sure your room is quiet and dark and that it's at a comfortable temperature. A lot of people prefer a little cooler when they're sleeping. Some people use white noise machines to mask any of the sounds around you, house sounds or outside sounds. And then really, really critical is making sure you're putting down your smartphone, you know, at least 30 minutes before bed. Your phone is going to stimulate your brain to stay active, and that's going to actually prevent you from falling asleep. And a lot of people know there's a blue light that comes from those artificial screens, and that can actually make your body feel more awake. So you want to make sure you turn off your blue light. There's a filter usually on your phone, and then wind down with something like a book instead of television or a phone.
And if you do wake up during the night, what's a good way to fall back asleep?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things you can do. We use this method called the 4-7-8 method, which is where you inhale through your nose for about 4 seconds, hold your breath for 7 seconds, and then you slowly exhale through your mouth for 8 seconds. And it's basically just a slow breathing technique to help relax you. You know, some people may want to put on a little soft music or that white noise that I mentioned. That can actually help you fall asleep as well.
What are some things you should not do?
Yeah, the most important thing is don't sit there watching the clock. That's just going to create more anxiety. It's going to make you feel frustrated and increase your stress, and then you're less likely to fall asleep. And a lot of people may wake up and then go grab their phone and start reading their phone, and that's going to trigger your brain to say, hey, it's morning, I'm awake. Really critical, though, is don't sit there and lie in bed. If you sit there for 20 minutes or longer, you're probably not going to fall asleep. Get up. You know, maybe get a glass of warm milk, do a relaxing activity, and then when you feel tired, try to go back to bed.
But any final advice, Doc, because it's such a magical, ethereal thing when you fall asleep. If you start thinking about falling asleep, then you're screwed. It's not going to happen, right? It just kind of happens. So any final advice?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's really hard to change our routines for a lot of things, but sleep in particular. So this has developed over a lot of years. Make these small positive changes. And like I said, consistency is critical. Stick with them, and better sleep is going to make you feel much better every morning.
Very valuable information. Thank you, Dr. B. Sweet dreams.
Thanks, Tommy. Have a great weekend.
You too, sir. If you want to find out more about People's Health, you can go to peopleshealth.com. You can call them at 1-800-978-9765. Or you can visit the People's Health Medicare Center, 3017 Vets, right next to Party City in Metairie. Appointments are recommended, but walk-ins are welcome. Taking a quick break now, WWL First News. 8:46, 14 to 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by Senator Kirk Talbot, a businessman who is going to get ready to go into session, legislative session on Monday. How you doing, Kirk?
I'm doing great. Good morning, Tommy. How are you?
I'm all right. Thanks for taking the time with us. So let's talk about insurance.
Sure.
Governor Landry yesterday calling out Morris Bart, but to be honest, he did go hunting with Gordon McKernan, whatever the guy's name is, last week. So where there's a will, there's a way. But my question is there really a will to change the atmosphere in Louisiana, the legal atmosphere, litigious atmosphere when it comes to auto insurance rates?
I do. You know, if you look at the amount of bills that were filed and the different number of legislators that have filed them, including myself, it is seems like this thing really has taken on a life of its own. Everybody's focused on it. I'm glad the governor had that press conference. I'm glad that he's pushing legislation and really focusing on this. I believe Tim Temple's having our insurance commissioner's having a press conference at 10:30 to lay out his package and his view. So there are a lot of people focused on this. It is something that obviously we need to do. There's some really good bills out there. And Tommy, the bills that are filed are not new ideas or, you know, shots in the dark. It's looking at what other states have done. They all have better rates than we do because we're the highest. So these are ideas and things that are tried and true that we can look at and say, well, how did this affect y'all's market? How does this affect, you know, the bottom line, and how does it affect rates? So it really is, as the governor says, it's data driven, and that's what we're looking at. We're looking at what other states do, what they've learned from, how tort reform has affected their rates, and that's what you see with this with these bills.
And to be fair to the governor, you know, it's a good chance, even though he went hunting with Gordon McKernan, that doesn't mean anything. It's a good chance to show me finish. It's a good chance to show that you can be friends with somebody. There's business and there's personal, right? So there's a way to take care of the state's business but still have a personal relationship. So I don't know that you necessarily have to read anything into that. The governor did, though, last year veto that collateral source proposal. Explain what that is, Kirk. He says it wouldn't have done anything to address the problem and took away the rights from those who are legitimately injured. Your thoughts on that collateral source bill?
Yeah, that was a bill, I think it was House Bill 213 by Representative Mellorin from Shreveport. So we have a really unique, convoluted system. So when a person gets injured and they use their insurance, there's a billed amount, and your listeners have probably seen this in medical bills they've had. You have the billed amount, which is usually very high compared to at the end of the statement, which is what you owe, right? Mm-hmm. It might say $10,000, and then you have the in-network discounts, the write-offs, the blah, blah, blah. And at the end, it could be as low as, let's say, $2,000. A lot of states, this sounds more common sense than it should, only let you recover what you actually paid. So a lot of states like Arkansas and Texas, if your bill was $2,000, then you get $2,000 back. Some states let you recover up to the billed amount, which is kind of a fictitious amount because no one is responsible for that $10,000. That's just the billed amount where the starting point. What we do in Louisiana is they take the billed amount and they subtract the paid amount, and whatever that difference is, in this case, $10,000 minus $2,000, $8,000, you can recover, I think it's up to 60% of that difference. What Mellorin's bill did was shrink that dollar amount and allow the billed amount and the paid amount to be admissible in court. Because right now, that is not admissible in court. From what I understand, I'm not an attorney, but from what I understand, only that billed amount is what the jury and the judge sees. So when they're calculating future medical expenses and the amount of money they want to give to the plaintiff, they're using a dollar amount that's artificially inflated. So that bill got vetoed, and the governor just thought that was the right thing for him to do, and that's certainly his prerogative.
Do you think it would have helped?
It might have helped a little bit. Brian Glorioso from Slidell has a bill out right now that takes away that formula. Says, look, if you can make the argument in front of the jury and the judge that you can collect up to that billed amount, go for it. But we want everything admissible, all the medical bills, so the judge and the jury can make an accurate determination on what to award that plaintiff. And what complicates things, Tommy, is more and more there are plaintiffs who get injured that are not using their insurance. So they're going to medical clinics or surgery centers or paying cash at hospitals. And so in some cases, not all, there are bills that are being submitted that are 300-500% higher than what's quote unquote usual and customary. And Brian Glorioso's bill, and I have a bill that does the same thing, allows testimony to whether that bill is reasonable. And I think that's a reasonable thing. And a lot of states do that. Florida, Texas, Georgia, they all do that.
Yeah, let me take a quick break. We'll pick it up there. We come back. We'll talk about no pay, no play, and also about what adopting a Texas model would look like. 852 traffic now, WWL. .857, 3 till 9, couple of minutes left with Kirk Talbot, a senator, talking about Louisiana and automobile insurance, and the governor saying if we adopt a Texas model, then I believe we will reach a fair and balanced approach. So, Kirk, I don't know the specifics, and it can be very complicated, but when it comes to the Texas model, what are they doing that we aren't doing, and how hard is it going to be to adopt that model? Who's going to have to be on board and vote for what?
Well, it's a little more complicated than just adopting their model. They have a different civil code that we have. But I think what the governor's talking about is, first, if someone uses their insurance, they can recover what the actual bill was, not that inflated billed amount. Then on the other side, if you choose not to use your insurance, things are admissible on whether what that insurance would have paid if you did use your insurance, and you can provide testimony to contest whether a bill that is used out of network is reasonable and customary. So it is a little different. We're looking at that now. They also have modified comparative fault. We have comparative fault, and that's a whole different discussion there. But there's four or five things that are done differently there, which I think we can do here. You know, I think that's definitely something. I mean, they have a $0 jury trial threshold. I believe ours is $10,000. So there's things we can do, and we are feverishly looking at that, I assure you.
So let me ask you about civil code, and I don't want to get too far into the weeds on this, but again, having played golf for money, I can tell you that the weeds are where most of the cheating happens. How do you change the civil code, Kirk, to make maybe that be a portion of fixing the insurance problem in Louisiana?
I mean, we have staff that can – I mean, we pull bills and ideas from other states all the time. So we have staff that can mold that and massage that into our code and make the words fit and make everything, you know, fit and make sense. So it's done all the time, Tommy. It's done every year. So it's possible. It may not be a pure switch over to the Texas model, but we can certainly get – almost all the way there.
Scale of 1 to 10, how confident are you that you and me and anybody else, because you pay them too, anybody else in Louisiana is going to see a significant decrease in auto insurance rates?
Look, I pay them too, and I might get rear-ended today, so I don't want to do anything to run, you know, to hurt my chances of recovering, you know, my expenses if I get hurt. But I think there's definitely a better than average chance that something's going to get done. The desire's there. You know, I'd say it's more than I've seen in my years in the legislature.
All right, we'll talk again. And merrily we go into the 9 o'clock hour. I was talking about doing morning shows most of my career. And look, I'm not complaining. I'm blessed. I love to do this. I have the best job in the world. But I asked people if they got up early, were they always tired? And one text comes in and says, I get up every morning at 2:30 the last 17 years. I just retired last August. I still get up at 2:30 just in time. I just don't have to go to work anymore. Somebody else texted in and said, I get up for work at 3 a.m. and I'm in bed by 7 p.m. I live tired. I heard that, brother. And somebody else said that I change my daily routine and wake up at 4 a.m. and work out every morning for Lent. I haven't looked forward to Easter this much since I gave up alcohol for Lent. It's just not normal, and I'm not complaining. I'm glad, I'm lucky, I'm blessed. But no human being is meant to be up at 3:30 a.m. If you're out, you should be in by that time, and if you're getting up to start the day, it's far too early. But I love what I do, so there you go. Let's talk about the House settlement and what's going on with name, image, and likeness in college football and college athletics. Matt Brown joins us, publisher of the Extra Points newsletter. He's our guy. How you doing, Matt?
Yeah, Tommy, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on, and I appreciated that listening to that in the beginning. I used to have one of those jobs where I got up at 3:34 in the morning, and I don't think I'd go back to that if you doubled my pay. Like that.
Were you tired?
That was
constantly?
Paleolithic man.
Were you tired constantly?
Oh, I'm sure. Well, I mean, I'm also tired constantly now, but I think that just comes from getting older and working 60 hours a week and having little kids. But no, when I taught elementary school and would get up at 3:34 to make sure I could get over the, get over the Huey in time and get to school. Yeah, by 2 o'clock I was exhausted. I was pounding 3 Celsiuses a day.
How old were you?
I was 22. Yeah. I was still skinny back then. It was just a lot.
I asked a family member a couple of years ago. Was I this tired when I was 20 something years old doing morning shows? And he said, "Yeah, you were. You were always tired. You were taking a nap. You were always lethargic." So it doesn't matter. The age doesn't matter. It's the hours. But thank you, Matt. Let's talk about the Extra Points newsletter. Then we'll get into the House settlement, and then we'll talk about the latest. Okay, for context.
Sure, absolutely. Friends, I run the Extra Points newsletter and have for the last 5 years. It uses original reporting that done by me and analysis that covers the off-the-field stories that shape the college athletics industry, from the largest SEC programs to the smallest Division III programs, everything from what's happening in Washington, D.C. and in courtrooms to what's happening with television rights and how schools earn and spend money and all of the things that shape what happens on the field on Saturdays and on the courts in the spring.
Since you mentioned Washington, let's start with tariffs because I don't know what time it is, what minute it is. I don't have the TV on. I don't know what's happened lately with tariffs. I think the question, and I don't mean to bring you into this morass, but I will say it.
Yeah.
I think the question, the ultimate question is the president crazy or crazy like a fox? And I guess we'll find out. What effect will tariffs have on college athletics or college sports?
Yeah, and it's interesting because you wouldn't typically think of college athletics as an industry that would be deeply exposed to tariffs because the games all happen here, the schools are all here, the live events and the television companies that broadcast them are all here. But I think one thing that a lot of folks are learning over the last week and a half is that almost every facet of our consumer lives and almost every industry really is interconnected globally. If we look at the major athletic programs just in the state of Louisiana, all of them are partnered with athletic apparel and equipment companies that do the vast majority of their manufacturing in Asia, not just in China. A lot in Vietnam, some in Bangladesh, some in Japan, but that's every basketball shoe. That's all of the hoodies and sweatshirts and performance apparel. It's a lot of the baseball equipment. Really, I was digging into this other than like football helmets and a lot of the manufacturing and maintenance around basketball courts. Most stuff in a weight room and on an athlete comes from Asia. And then a lot of the materials that we use to build stadiums, to refurbish locker rooms, to handle campus construction, a lot of that, those raw materials come from Canada, they come from Mexico, and they come from Asia too. So if we're looking at a world where you're right, we don't really know what the rules are because they change every 8 hours, and maybe it's 10%, maybe it's 130%. You know, I haven't checked the news yet either. Mm-hmm. But those kinds of increases will be passed on not just to consumers, but to corporations that purchase large amounts of those materials, and that will include entities like Tulane and LSU. And whether that money either has to get passed on to consumers in the form of higher ticket prices, or it's going to get passed on to lower services or cuts elsewhere in those athletic departments.
I don't mean to go here, but since you mentioned it, I was talking to a high school football coach not too long ago, and he told me, and I'm not going to mention any names, that the principal didn't want him to cut anybody from the football team because they want every student that is on the football team continues to pay tuition, and they were afraid that if they cut somebody, then maybe they'd go to another school and they'd lose that tuition, and that's an empty seat, because ultimately, let's face it, a school is a business. One way or the other, you got to put butts in the seats, right, to cover your bills.
And unquestionably.
And you mentioned the cost of football helmets and everything else. I don't think people realize, since you brought it up, how much a football helmet costs and how much it takes to protect athletes, insurance, and everything else.
It's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. And for one, I think what you're actually describing there at maybe the private high school level is a really important principle, because this is the single biggest reason why so many smaller universities, whether you're a small D1 school like a University of New Orleans or a McNeese potentially, and certainly institutions at Division II and Division III, they're not using their athletic departments to make money from selling tickets and television rights. They're using their athletic departments to earn tuition revenue, because and they'll have big old rosters, and they'll expand to have lots of sports, and that's why anybody has a stunt program or a beach volleyball program. It's for tuition revenue, and you know, some of the other things I think we'll talk about in this segment potentially impact that. Even for a small institution that's getting a 60% off discount from Adidas to go buy a bunch of their stuff, over the course of a fiscal year, it's easily over $500,000 just for shoes and clothes and batting helmets and swimsuits. When you add in the health insurance, when you add in the concussion protocol and having to have trainers, which are very difficult people to hire anywhere in the country, forget paying your football coach $3 million, forget some of the fancy stuff. Yeah, you're looking at bare minimum $5-7 million to run an athletic department, even a very small one. And tariffs, as well as many, many other things, can significantly impact those costs.
What about, since we're talking about Washington, D.C., international players, Marco Rubio saying that the United States is revoking all visas held by South Sudanese passport holders, including the African nation's government of taking advantage of the United States, advantage of the U.S. A basketball star on the Duke team is among those that could be deported due to the new policy. Is that something that's on the radar of coaches and college teams?
If it wasn't on the radar for coaches a week and a half ago, it certainly is now. And this is something I'm in the process of doing some more reporting on, and hopefully we'll have something early next week. But what I can tell you is that the percentage of athletes that are typically international students varies pretty significantly by sport, right? There's not a whole lot of folks from South Sudan who are playing high-level college football right now. To the extent that they're not American, they tend to be either punters or special teams athletes from Australia or some folks from Canada. But for other sports, and like not just soccer, but for swimming and for tennis and golf, you might have an international athlete population of 40 or 50 or even higher percent, like particularly for tennis. Mm-hmm. The majority of those athletes tend to come from Western Europe or from higher income families in many Asian countries like South Korea. And then you have some from South America. But this is a risk. I mean, even well before Senator Rubio was confirmed as Secretary of State in the very beginning of this transition, I remember talking to some coaches at Hawaii who were terrified, because one of the, you know, Hawaii's major recruitment strategies for all their whole athletic department is Australia and New Zealand and Japan, because they're only a 5-hour flight from those places compared to, you know, 15 hours for maybe some other parts of the, you know, of the country. And they were already worried that they might lose some of their coaches or 40-50% of some of their rosters. It is a major issue. It's probably not something that's going to keep Brian Kelly up at night, but there are going to be some college tennis and golf coaches who are going to be very concerned, even if they're not recruiting athletes from Jordan or from South Sudan or from you know, international hotspots, because some of those parents are going to say, yeah, sure, Spain's fine now, but how can I be sure they're going to be fine in 6 months?
And that's the other question about recruiting, where, and going back to the whole question about bringing manufacturing here, and I'm not asking you about that, but, you know, it's like, how do you plan when you don't know what the future's going to be? And I would think when it comes to recruiting, what would a college coach do? Not look to those countries?
It would be hard. And I think maybe a good way to think about it for maybe folks listening here
is it's not so much that a rule is bad or not, but it's the not knowing. If you were trying to plan your commuting route and the toll road on some of the bridges around here changed every 2 or 3 days, and sometimes you had to drive on the left lane or sometimes the right lane going over the bridges, or sometimes there would be lots of traffic enforcement and some none at all, trying to figure out when to leave for work or how to plan everything would be really difficult. It's going to be $6 to cross one bridge, it sucks, but at least there's some stability there. That is not the case right now in college sports on almost every level. And that's true for international recruiting. And you're right. Some people will just decide it's not worth the instability. I'm not going to look in those places anymore. And it's true for a lot of regulations on athlete compensation, what the rules are for NIL and how you might be able to get in trouble or how any of that works. It's not so much that the rules are bad. It's that nobody really has any sense of finality or security about what they're going to be in 3 or 6 months. That's very difficult.
I'll tell you this. I'm not in that business, Matt Brown, but I'm glad I do have this job. And even though I have to get up at 3 a.m. to bring it full circle back to where we started, I'd much rather do that than be involved in this mess. We'll pick it up when we come back about name, image, and likeness, house settlement, and more. Talking to Matt Brown, publisher of the Extra Points newsletter, 921, Tommy Tucker, back in a flash, WWL. 9:28 now. Federal court hearing on Monday lasted 7 hours. Now, I just want you to think about that. That would be from now until what, 4:30 in the afternoon, I guess? Testimony from athletes and lawyers and objections, I'm sure, and this and that and the other thing about the settlement for past, present, and future Division I athletes. That's who the attorneys were representing, I guess. The judge says, I think it's a good settlement, but don't quote me, that there are a lot of things left to be answered. Livy Dunn came out and said that she didn't like the settlement, didn't think it was fair. Matt Brown, publisher of the Extra Points newsletter, for context, tell us quickly how all of this started and where we are and what happens from here.
Yeah, sure. This has been a conversation that's been happening for more than the last year and a half, combining multiple antitrust lawsuits against the NCAA and power conferences. The antitrust lawsuits primarily concern prior athletes who did not get a chance to take advantage of NIL rights, whether that was from brands or from EA Sports video games or other opportunities, and that other recruiting and NIL restrictions are an unfair restraint of trade. NCAA and the big conferences did not want to go to trial over this, because if they went and they lost, and they would probably lose, they would face treble damages and literally bankrupt the NCAA. The liabilities would extend well into the billions of dollars. And so the two sides have come together and hashed out a settlement to these cases, right? You'll see this in the news called the House settlement. The last hearing for that settlement to see if it would be approved was earlier this week. You're right, it did take 7 hours. And the industry expectation, if you talk to Greg Sankey, you talk to an athletic director, big school, small school, anywhere, the industry expectation for the last 2.5 months is that this settlement would eventually be approved. Probably wouldn't happen on April 7th. They were going to expect some final tweaks, and it looked like those are probably going to happen with walk-on limits. But that then the settlement will ultimately likely be approved, which would mean that starting in July, schools can then begin to directly pay athletes rather than having to rely on third-party collectives or outside groups, and that there will be new limits and new rules on how athletes are paid and how large the size of rosters and scholarships can be for those college athletes.
This will be a settlement, not a judgment, so there will be no appeal, or am I wrong?
Well, as I understand it, once this thing is approved, there will almost certainly be immediate lawsuits challenging it.
There you go.
From Title IX grounds, which are not part of this particular evaluation, from athletes that opted out and wanted to sue the NCAA on other grounds. But while those appeals and additional lawsuits are happening, the settlement will continue. So even if people are suing to complain about this, athletes are going to get paid starting this summer.
How do you go about determining back pay and for whom?
It's a really good question, and the exact math has not been shared with plebeian reporters like me or with a lot of other people. It's a bunch of other economists and lawyers got in a room and tried to make some calculations based on games played or snaps or social media followings. And it's heavily based on sport formulas. So the vast majority of this back pay is going to go to football and men's basketball players rather than swimmers or track athletes who probably would not have been able to get very much name, image, or likeness money anyway compared to somebody who might have been the runner-up for a Heisman Trophy. To me, I think that the most relevant information here for fans of college athletics is not so much the back pay or the back penalties, where a few athletes are going to get really significant money, but what it means for college sports moving forward, with now every athletic department essentially having a salary cap to spread out among different sports to pay people directly.
Athletic departments, so what happens to the golf team? What happens to the, I'm trying to think of the lacrosse team? Are there...
Yeah.
Does it go back to what we talked to earlier about, yeah, come here, play lacrosse if you pay tuition? Does it go to, we're not going to pay anybody to play golf or lacrosse? Instead, we'll give the money to football program? I'm just wondering what the results will be or if we can anticipate that.
We can, and it's a great question, and I think one of the really interesting things is that every institution can decide how they want to split up that money themselves. There is a kind of rough back of the napkin math that I would say is most common, where schools many schools are saying, we're going to distribute roughly 75% of our cap to football, roughly 15% to men's basketball, roughly 5% to women's basketball, and 5% to everything else. But there's going to be some pretty significant variances depending on the institution. And I'll give an example. Like, I'm based in Chicago. I'm up here in Big Ten country. And one sport that's very, very important to many Big Ten schools that is not really a thing here in the Southeast is men's wrestling. Mm-hmm. At Iowa and Penn State, these programs are profitable. They are on both linear television and pay-per-view, and thousands of people go. And Iowa and Penn State, and to some extent Ohio State and a few other programs, are absolutely going to have to allocate hundreds of thousands of dollars to support their men's wrestling programs. There's a few wrestling programs in the South that are going to allocate some of that money. That's not a thing Alabama is going to be doing. Mm-hmm. There's going to be some programs, I think, in the SEC that are going to say, we need to make sure we allocate money for women's gymnastics. That's a big deal here. We sell lots of tickets. We send people to the Olympics. We want to be competitive. We want to have the next SUNY Lee here. That's important for our department. So we have to allocate some of that money. There's going to be some schools that don't have football that are going to say, we're going to really go all in on basketball. And you might even have some programs that might shock people. They're going to have bigger salary cap or operating budgets for basketball than some Big Ten or SEC schools. I don't think there's a right answer. It depends a lot on how much you trust your ability to give money to the right athletes, and also what's important to your fan base and where do you have the best chance of winning a championship.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back 9:35, 25 till 10. I want to go down a little bit from there and how that affects the Olympic teams, how it affects high school sports, because I was saying the other day, Matt, I go to the driving range occasionally, and I got a lot of parents out there with kids that they are hoping for a college scholarship, and I was having a conversation with somebody. If they have the skills, you may be able to develop them, but to think you're going to give your kid the skills that you need to be a professional golfer just by going to the driving range, I don't think is realistic. So we'll talk about, and you understand what I'm saying, and people
do
that. And it's like I'm guessing you or I, no matter what kind of training we had, no matter what practice we had, we could never be professional golfers. We could never be professional athletes, and not everybody can. But I think some people think that. We'll talk about the effect down the line of this settlement and more. 9:36, 24 till 10. Traffic now, WWL. 9:42, 18 till 10. Interesting hour with Matt Brown, our friend, publisher of the Extra Points newsletter, about the House settlement that is not about the House of Representatives. It's about a swimmer, and it concerns name, image, and likeness, and colleges directly paying athletes. And before we get to, every action having a reaction, how does this factor in with name, image, and likeness? The college will pay the player, but they can still have name, image, and likeness money?
Yeah, the way it will work is the university will send an athlete a contract and say, I am going to pay you $110,000 a year for you to while you're participating in these athletic programs for the school to buy your NIL rights. So we will get to use you on billboards or on promotional materials throughout the university or commercials. But you can also continue to do deals independently of this if they're based on fair market value, which is going to be determined not by the NCAA, but by Deloitte, a massive accounting and consulting company that's been retained by these four major institutions. So if you are somebody like Libby Dunn, who has an enormous social media following and has done deals with energy drink companies and has equity in other firms and gets paid a lot of money for that, you can continue to do that. There's nothing stopping any Louisiana athlete from doing an ad for a seafood restaurant, just like we heard a minute or two ago. But they will also be paid some amount of money from the institution itself, in addition to their scholarship and cost of attendance and insurance.
How about transfer portal? Because it would seem to me, if you sign a contract with me, well, then I got you locked up through your college career. But that's not the way it's going to work, right?
Well, it's an interesting thing, right? Because if you're making a 6 or 7 figure bet on an 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old, I think you and I both know from knowing people that are that age, that's not the most predictable group of people in the world.
I would think that's accurate.
Yeah, you lock somebody up for 4 years at that particular salary and they get hurt or they are turned out to just not be that good or something else happens. Now you've got dead cap money.
The other side of it is you could pay this guy for 1 year and then it's like free agency in the NFL or whatever sport. Then all of a sudden he squirts you and he jumps over to – he goes from LSU just picking teams to Alabama for more money and he's playing against you next year.
That's exactly right. And so that's part of the calculus that will be negotiated between player, agent, and school. I imagine if you're a school like, again, you know, just picking a random one here, if you're like CELA, right, if you're Southeastern Louisiana or you're one of these kind of Southlands programs – you would probably want to lock people up as long as you can, but you're not going to be able to. And part of the recruiting pitch is come here, start, do well for 2 years. We'll get you exposure. And then if LSU comes calling, you know, God bless, I'm not going to tell you not to take $1 million. The big schools are going to have to figure out who do I want to make a long-term commitment to up front versus who do we want to renegotiate with. I have seen some of these contracts from a couple of schools through Open Records and through agents sharing them with me. Many of them do have provisions that say, like, okay, you know, you'll get paid this amount every other month, but if you transfer or if you leave this zip code, then this deal is null and void as a way of trying to encourage to keep people. But that's going to be one of the challenges.
So seriously, will a Northeastern I'm picking schools, Northwestern State, will a Southeastern, a McNeese, really have a $20.5 million salary cap? Will they have the money for that or not?
Not a chance. And I'm not saying this to be disrespectful to our brothers and sisters in the Southland Conference, right? But, like, I've got your budget on my computer.
Or UNO even.
You don't make $20 million. Mm-hmm. So you can't share $20 million if that's not in your bank account. You're going to have some schools that are going to say, we're not going to share anything. And it's, or we're going to wait a year before we share anything. We're going to give you your cost of attendance money and your scholarship and your Alston Award. And depending on how taxes break, that actually might be in your advantage. Mm-hmm. What's more likely for these smaller, you know, low major institutions is that they're going to have a budget of between $2 and $4 million. And then they're going to have to decide how much of that do I want to put on football, basketball, or and maybe for some of the smaller schools locally here, baseball. I think you know, this market understands there are some Southland schools that can absolutely beat LSU on a Wednesday, mm-hmm. and make, you know, win a couple of games in the postseason. And $800,000 goes a little bit further on a college baseball team than it might on a college basketball team. It's a tricky calculation to make.
So the smaller schools, in essence, become the minor leagues to develop players for the professional major leagues, which is now the bigger colleges.
I think in many ways that is true, and also in many ways that has been true for the last couple of years, right? If you looked at the rosters of the teams in the Final Four and the Elite Eight of the last men's basketball tournament, you saw a lot of guys who started their career at North Florida or at low majors or, as OVC kind of teams. They weren't all 4- and 5-star guys that were signed out of high school. It's less the case in football, but there is some upward mobility. And if you're somebody who's a sophomore and you make all Sun Belt, there's a pretty good chance the SEC and the ACC is going to come calling the next year. I understand why fans of some of those other programs are upset about that, but the winds blow both ways. And there's going to be a lot of kids who are fourth string at LSU who then start thinking, you know what? Mm-hmm. Tulane doesn't sound so bad. And maybe somebody who wouldn't have picked up the phone at 17 will be way more interested in heading uptown at 20.
And that brings you to problems with maybe depth at the larger schools, right?
Unquestionably, particularly for college football right now, if you're going to make the national championship game, you're essentially playing an NFL-length season. And this was actually something that I heard from Ryan Day and a couple of Ohio State coaches after the championship game, that they changed the way that they called games, where they played a deliberately slower tempo, where they would have fewer offensive snaps. And maybe that frustrated Buckeye fans are like, why are we only beating Akron by 28? Like, why are we not running up stats to make the Heisman? But the hope is, hey, if we shave off 12 plays here, 12 plays there, our guys are going to be more fresh when it's time to play Texas and Notre Dame in January.
And as you say think of an unintended consequence of betting lines, right? As prolific as betting has become. Let me get this text real quick. Is there a problem with college agents, like different agents claiming they all represent the same athlete? Pardon me, are there any regulations on who can be an agent or qualifications they have to have?
This is a very important question, and it is one of the single biggest differences between the NFL and NBA and college sports right now. The short answer is, my friends, there are virtually no regulations on who can be a college agent.
So I could call myself an agent tomorrow, right?
You absolutely could. You just change your Twitter profile, update your LinkedIn bio, and you start going. If you want to represent a player on the Saints, you need to be certified by the NFLPA. And that usually means you have to have a graduate degree or a law degree. You have to pass an ethics exam. You have to have years of experience. And basically the union wants to make sure that you're not some complete, unethical or unqualified person. We don't have that at the college level. Every state has different licensing or certification rules for sports agents, but none of them are enforced on any meaningful level. And so what you're describing of agents in college saying that they represent guys that they don't, people who are flagrantly breaking NCAA and sometimes state and federal law, people who are charging exorbitant fees, all of that happens. If you want to say in any area here is the Wild West, which is a term that I really don't like, that is true in the agency world. There are some people that I think are not on the short list of going to heaven working in that space.
Lord knows. I want to get to this real quick, and that's unintended consequences of looking down the line with kids in college sports or even high school sports, and how that could affect young people, the schools, sports, et cetera. Your thoughts, Matt?
Yeah, one of the, I think, really beautiful things about college athletics, legitimately in this country, is that it is one of the single biggest scholarship programs, and I think, of abilities to create class mobility and generational wealth in this entire country. Like, other than the GI Bill, there isn't a single, to the best of my knowledge, there's not a scholarship program in this country larger than college sports. And that means that there's going to be thousands of people who might not be going to college otherwise that have it through this program, whether that's football or whether that's field hockey. And when we have changes in this financial system that further incentivize schools to move resources to consolidate in football and men's and women's basketball, and I'm not saying that that's unethical or wrong. I understand those choices. In many ways, I think that's the right thing to do. But that will mean that there will be scholarship resources taken away from some of those other sports.
Also,
that will hurt us in the Olympics, and it could hurt people's college opportunities.
And I think another thing is there are a lot of lessons to be learned in sports just from playing the sport itself, not compensation or scholarships. And I just wonder if that makes sports disappear, and as a result, then those lessons aren't learned.
I think there really is some risk of that. I think that's especially a concern of mine at the high school and youth levels, whether those opportunities disappear. Where I live in Chicago, my daughters go to Chicago Public Schools. I'm in the northwest side of the city. a lot of our schools don't have sports. My oldest is in fifth grade. There's no sports offered at her school. You have to wait until they get into sixth for some of those things. And part of that is because of money. And there are travel groups or there's third-party groups, but they're exorbitantly expensive. Yep. I think your earlier point, right, you talk to families, there's probably people in this market where their goal is to get their kid a golf or a tennis scholarship or a baseball scholarship, and we know that those private lessons and those AAU groups and those extra training opportunities cost a lot of money,
yep.
Right? If you're going to a recovery school district, your program somewhere and you're not pulling in 90 grand, you might not have some of those opportunities. And to me, as a former educator and someone that cares big picture about that stuff, I do worry about losing those lessons. Many places. Yeah.
Got to go. Excellent hour as always. Thank you, sir. We'll talk to you again soon. Matt Brown, publisher of the Extra Point newsletter, 954. We'll talk to Newell when we come back, see what he's got for you today here on WWL.